The Problem Gambling Podcast is proudly sponsored by Gamban, the simple and effective way to block access to online gambling on all your devices. If willpower slips, Gamban doesn't. Go to gamban.com to find out more.
Hello and welcome to the Problem Gambling Podcast. I'm Barry Grant, an addiction counsellor with Extern Problem Gambling, and my co-host is Tony O'Reilly, also an addiction counsellor with The Project and the co-author of the book Tony 10. Today, we're delighted to have as our guest Steve Watts from the UK charity GamFam, which supports family members affected by a loved one's gambling, which I think is one of the most important and yet one of the most ignored areas around gambling addiction. And myself and Tony get calls from family members on a pretty much on a daily basis who are in severe distress as a result of their loved one's gambling problem. So Steve, thank you so much for joining us today. Do you want to tell us a little bit about how GamFam started out?
Yeah, morning Barry, morning Tony. Thanks for having me on. GamFam, how did it start? Well, my son, he developed a gambling disorder, probably lived with it for about 3 years. My background is education. I worked in education for years, and as a parent, I had no idea what a gambling disorder was. You know, we receive education on drugs, alcohol, road safety, sex education, all of that thing. We're sort of conditioned to learn about that, but never in that time was there ever a mention of gambling disorder. So, myself, I always enjoyed a bet myself, and when my son showed an interest in putting on a football accumulator, I thought he'd be like the old block, but did I know that 3 years later that his gambling would become more than just a few social bets and it was when he got onto the online casinos and stuff that probably that started. And we wasn't in a position to know what to do and how to help and how to support, and we probably made the same mistakes as every other parent would make in that situation. So when we started accessing support through Gammonon, family version of Gamblers Anonymous, and we went there probably for 3 to 4 months before my son was ready to take a look at how he was working towards his recovery, and I was quite frustrated at the time that there wasn't any support out there, so I started, and I was inspired to go into schools and parents about the dangers of online gambling, 10 things to look for, 10 things to do, with the type of approach that we took. This wasn't going in talking to the children, it was going in talking to the parents. And I was doing that while I was still working in the school, and got some really, really good positive feedback about that. And we were due to be going into sixth form colleges and schools and hopefully universities. But obviously because of COVID, that all sort of stopped. And we started then looking at our self-help programs. Now, I talk about Gammonon. Interestingly, sort of in the UK, there, for every Gammonon, there's four to five Gamblers Anonymous, and there's not enough support out there for families. So there was an opportunity there to try and create it and hopefully support people and help people join up the dots quicker. That's what got us into that. So it started off as being an education program, but because of COVID, we had to sort of rethink of how we could support and help, because schools didn't speak to their parents. So we developed our GRASS program.
And can you tell us a bit about the GRASS program? I was just looking over it there before we came on, but obviously it's better coming from you. It's a kind of a 5-stage program.
It's a peer support program, a structured peer support program. And what we offer is an opportunity. We did plan on launching it face to face first of all, and the plan was we would do our education program in the local area and do our GRASS program in the local area, but again because of COVID we had to be creative. So the GRASS program is run remotely via Zoom, which I'd probably say isn't as good as face-to-face meetings, but Zoom meetings are better than no meetings whatsoever. But what the real benefit of our Zoom programs is that we can help people in any location in any sort of part of the UK, and obviously now in Ireland as well, through our connection with Tony's sort of working with us as well, and sort of referred people into us. But it is a platform where people can come together and talk, and they can they can talk in a safe space where that no one's going to judge what they're saying. It gives people hope. I think hope is a small word, but just a big part of what we do, because when you're talking to people who understand what you're going through, it's probably one of the biggest benefits, and you get that genuine empathy. Because when you talk about gambling disorder with people who haven't really experienced it, you get this insincere sympathy. But that empathy and where you can relate to the people you're talking to is so important. We give people obviously practical advice and guidance through our 12 things to do. And then we've got a structured program that runs alongside it. I think just getting together every single week and just sharing your story and talking about the weather and the price of fish probably get a bit tiresome for some people. So we have got a structured program that underpins that, which is our 5-stage program called GRASP.
And what would the 5 stages of that be, Steve?
So the first stage is really, as an affected other, when you come into this space, you've got no real understanding of what a gambling disorder is and how it works. So it's really understanding what a gambling disorder is, how the gambling industry works. We pick up on that slight change. We talk about a bit about gaming. We talk about the way that the industry works in terms of the products, the advertising. So really, we give people that grounding at stage one, where hopefully they can understand what their loved one has been going through. I mean, for us, I think we was probably filled with anger and resentment. But by understanding it is a recognised mental health disorder, that helped us have some genuine empathy for our son. And I can honestly say today, as we're here today, we've got no anger and resentment at all. You know, genuine empathy with our son, what he was going through at the time. And I think that's really, really important at the start. And it helps the affected others unlock you know, how they can help and support their loved ones best possible way. So that's stage one. Stage two, we start looking at our own role and recovery. And we start looking at a bit of mindfulness in that. And this isn't a guide on mindfulness. I'm not an expert in that. There's a lot of people out there that have written a lot more worthy things about mindfulness. But we touched on that, and we encourage our group members to go and research that. But we also work with a local charity called Suffolk Mind, and we use their Your Needs Met program, which is based on the Human Givens wellbeing program that looks at the 9 emotional, I don't know if you're familiar with it, the 9 emotional needs that you need to meet to be emotionally healthy, and the 3 physical needs. So we're really delighted to have a partner like Suffolk Mind working with us, and I think that gives our program you know, a lot of credit with that as well. Stage three, we move on and we look at how we try to be the best version of ourselves and how we can how we respond to our loved one, and we use the chimp paradox. Again, I'm sure you fellas are fully aware of that, but I would recommend that as a lesson for life for anybody. I used that in my time in education when I was dealing with sort of let's say strictly young men, 15-year-olds, just about how to control themselves and how to sort of manage your reaction. So I think in the fog, and when you're dealing with your loved ones, you end up saying things that you probably don't mean to say. You get caught up in the moment, and just being able to press that emotional pause button and just taking that step back allows you to be more objective and more sort of more empathetic. Again, I use the word empathy quite a bit. But you understand what they're going through, and it saves any pointless arguments. Where, you know, sometimes if I'm being completely honest, I've looked back and I probably escalated matters when. Because I didn't know how to react to it. So for me, that's a really sort of relatable sort of model. It's a simplified model of the psychological mind as well. And I think it's understandable and accessible. Then we go into stage 4, where really is about review and reflection. We go back and we look at the first 3 stages, how we've behaved, and we look at how we behaved when our loved one was gambling. And it's all about us. Our program isn't about the person in recovery, it's about our recovery. It's always important to remember that, you know, something we say quite a bit, when you put in, they use it on an aeroplane, don't they? You put your own oxygen mask on first before you put someone else's on. And that probably is the, you know, the philosophy of the program. It's about our own well-being and our own recovery. So in stage 4, it's a lot about reflection. We look at how we behaved during our loved one's gambling and how we're behaving now after gambling and see what differences there are. And then in stage 5, we look at how we then can transfer what we've learned into our everyday life. And hopefully come out the other end as a better version of ourselves than when we walked in. Each each stage as well has got three tasks at the end of it. So it's all varied tasks. Some are sort of research based. Some are written tasks, etc. But anyway, I mean, I can talk you through some of those in a bit more detail.
Well, that's fascinating. There's a lot in there. And I'm amazed to hear you talking about the human givens, because it's something I love their approach, and they have a lot of really interesting tools and, I suppose, approaches available to a wide variety of things, especially anxiety and panic. That they have a lot of really good stuff around that. But I suppose they're not widely known, say, as widely known as something like CBT, but they have loads of really, really, really good stuff. The chimp paradox, for people who don't know what that is, could you tell the listener what that is?
Yeah, so the chimp, in its simplest form, there's some good podcasts, sort of videos out there as well, and the audio book is great as well. I would recommend that. But the chimp paradox is just a simplified version of the psychological mind, where Steve Peters, he's done a lot of work with the British Athletics team and lots of high-level sportsmen. And you boys will probably be able to be a bit more of an expert on this than me. I'm not claiming to be an expert on this, but my understanding of it is that the human mind is dividing it three areas. You've got the human part of our brain, which is the rational part of our brain, the chimp, which is the irrational and emotional side, and also the computer. And the computer is where you store your values, and you go onto autopilot. And what it says when you're faced with a decision is that unless we're storing our computer with those positive values and beliefs, the chimp can also jump in and react before the human gets a chance. But I think the chimp is five times quicker than the human to react. So we need to learn to train our chimp. And
the chimp is five times faster than the human, and that's well established. It's that kind of old kind of lizard part of the brain, let's say like the fight or flight part, where, you know, if you're in fight or flight and or let's say you're in the woods and a bear jumps out, fight or flight should kick in at that point, and you either run, yeah, or if you have to, worst case scenario, you try and fight off the bear. If the human or the computer part of the brain, that kind of prefrontal cortex, the kind of decision-making part of the brain, starts going, is that a black bear or a brown bear? Because black bears are really fast at running, but brown bears are really good at climbing trees. And at this point, you're dead, right? So like switching on or that kind of decision-making part of the brain in a life or death situation is no use to you whatsoever. So that kind of impulsive chimp response has to be quicker than the prefrontal cortex. Absolutely. Response. And I suppose in addiction, you're creating these neural pathways between, you know, the kind of autopilot and the chimp, where you're kind of cutting out the decision making process and the thinking about the consequences process almost completely, right? And everything just becomes a knee-jerk reaction to stimuli around you. You know, you're having a bad day, you're having a good day, you got paid, whatever it is, you know, everything becomes a trigger to gamble or drink or do drugs or whatever the thing might be. You're explaining that beautifully, and I think that's a really good point. And of course, that is true for the person in addiction, or you keep using the current term gambling disorder, which of course is 100% correct. That's the 2013 DSMV Diagnostic Statistical Manual term for gambling disorder. Before it was pathological gambling, and it's had many, many names, and I suppose we tend to refer to it as problem gambling because it just covers a broader spectrum rather than, let's say, a person who meets the diagnostic criteria for gambling disorder. Not everybody that we work with would meet that bar, but they're still in trouble, you know, if that makes sense. Go on.
I think it's an interesting point. I mean, you know, we don't try to get too hung up on terminology. I think it's what people are comfortable with calling it. And for us, you know, we do refer to it as gambling disorder. As a parent, that helped me to detach myself from the gambling itself. And rather than blaming my son all the time, the gambling disorder allowed us to recognise that the part that the gambling industry possibly played in that with the addictive product, the advertising, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that really, really helped us have that empathy for him. And that's why we refer to it as a gambling disorder. But I know other people have got different approaches. That's where we are on that one.
Yeah, and I'm not disputing your way of looking at that either. I think that is a really helpful one. And of course, a person can develop all sorts of different disorders. You don't have to be born with it. It doesn't have to be a genetic thing. You know, there are lots of different pathways to getting to that point. And certainly I think for family members and for the person themselves, being able to say, well, look, this is a diagnosable condition, right? And hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions of people around the world are experiencing this condition, this disorder right now, and many more will into the future, just to be able to get a grip on it rather than the kind of old school mentality of you're just behaving irresponsibly, right? Yeah, exactly. which is this judgmental view, and you would have seen that with alcohol in the past as well. Tony, I'm sorry, you had a thought or a question there for Steve.
You're moving on from it now, but I'll come in anyway.
Go back.
Just to go back in about the chimp paradox, it's something I use a lot with clients as well. I think it's a really good model to use, an example, because it is all about triggers. And, you know, I've talked to Barry, you know, as well as a colleague, is a good friend. And sometimes I get triggered in my recovery, and it's about recognizing those triggers. And sometimes, you know, the chimp brain kicks in, and the human brain can't, you know, logically think, well, I don't have to react in this way. And that's the exact same when we're triggered within gambling, whether that's advertisement, whether it's promotions, whether it's internal triggers like stress, anxiety, relationship conflicts, whatever it is. So I think it's a really good model to use, because, and I like the way you said about the family member that you would sometimes had to kind of take a step back and try to react differently as well. Because if people don't get that kind of support, or family members don't get that insight, sometimes, you know, that can be just that creates conflict between the person in recovery and the family in recovery. And that can be, in my mind or in my experience, that can be the biggest trigger. But for me personally, it's one of the bigger triggers. It's looking back at historically the different relationships and how they've been affected, and maybe that some people haven't moved on from, you know, from the anger part. But also then it's about how I work within that as well. So it's interesting that you use that, because it's a brilliant book. Now, again, it's like many books that I've started the first half hour of the audiobook. I have the book as well, but I really think it's really good for both the person in recovery and the family in recovery to get that insight. So it's brilliant that it's part of the group. Now, I had known what GE had done, but I didn't know the exact breakdown of the GRASP group. But for you to explain that really, and the human Givens approach as well, which is something I've read up on before, as with Barry, we often discuss it on the podcast as well as ourselves, which really good, because it gives such a great insight for the family members to kind of look at the gambling disorder or gambling addiction in a totally different light. And I think that needs to happen for that kind of holistic recovery within the family to move forward. I think it's really important. So it's great to hear that, that's nearly front and center. And it sounds like a really kind of complete course, which is brilliant as well. And I know you were saying, you're on, like, we connected there a good few months ago now. I think it was in the water for the office at the time. I remember emailing it because I saw it, and we got chatting, and you know, for us to be able to refer some family members into you has been invaluable to us at a time when maybe we haven't been able to provide that service yet. So it's huge, and I know that the people we have referred in, it's had a huge impact on the client's recovery as well, because they're getting extra support from both sides. So we're able to tackle it from the family member side and from the person who was suffering from the disorder. So I think that's a huge take in the plus box, but I think it's invaluable for us to be able to, and then also I'm sure you'll touch on it, for us to be able to refer some clients who are coming near the end of treatment into the gamblers group as well, which is, it's absolutely brilliant. I've been inundating you with texts over the last couple of months, but it's brilliant. And I know that from the feedback from the people that we've been talking to, client-wise, it's been invaluable for their family members. So I just wanted to say, like, you know, brilliant. It's brilliant that it's there for us to be able to do it. But as you said, we need more of these. We need these all over the place. We need CAMFAM in every, you know, main town or city in both Ireland and the UK.
Oh, listen, thanks for your positive words about our programme. And we hooked up a while back, didn't we? And, you know, you came onto one of our groups and shared your story, and had a real, really, really positive impact on our group. And you know, as affected others to hear the story from someone directly in recovery, it helps us join up the pieces and join up the dots, and helps us with our recovery. Because, you know, getting that, as I said right at the start, getting that genuine empathy for our loved ones, and not being angry and resentful, and understanding you know, and recognise it's a gambling disorder. That helps us in our recovery. So that was a big turning point for our group when you came on. You know, we really appreciated that, and we've invited other people onto our groups as a consequence. And we've got other groups that run that the people in recovery have gone on to as well. I think it's just important that we're all on a similar or same page as possible. Yeah, it's important that family members, affected others are getting support in their recovery. It's no good us sitting at home being angry and resentful when our loved ones are accessing support via counselling, GA, different peer support groups. So, you know, the quicker we get on the same page or similar pages, we're all in this together, and we support one another, which is really, really important. Can I just pick up on a couple of things that you mentioned as well, Tony, as well, about the chimp paradox as well, and Barry, what you said. I totally agree with you about, you know, the chimp isn't a bad thing, because when the building's on fire, we want the chimp to sort of react and get us out of there, as you said with the bell. But it's learning to manage that chimp, isn't it? And if we put it back in the gambling context, I know that in my own personal situation that often, you know, we would be in the middle of a discussion and I would say the wrong thing and overreact. And what I need to do, as I've said previously, just emotional pause button, give myself a chance to count to 10, walk away from it, and then not escalate the situation, which is really, really important. And what happens once you start using that and trying to be that best version of yourself is that you end up transferring that into your everyday life. And probably an easy example to translate that to is that road rage when someone cuts you up and they drive in front of you, and the first thing you want to do is give your hooter and, you know, swear at them or whatever, and then you look over and it's a little old lady, and then you realise you feel really, really bad. So what I've noticed is since I've been working on this program and working on, you know, my own recovery, it's those instances where in the past I might have been, you know, quick to react, take a bit of a deep breath and just trying to be that best version of myself. I know that best version of myself will, he's not a bad bloke, you know, and he will get things right most of the time. It's the angry, the resentful, the impatient, you know, those type of versions of myself that get it wrong. If I can suppress that, and I can use the chimp paradox to help me relate to that, then, you know, hopefully I'm going to be in a better place day to day, you know, as well as dealing with the gambling as well. So it's important for me to translate that into everyday life as well. I don't claim to be an expert, by the way. It's just my interpretation. You fellas are, highly qualified in this. We are just a peer support group trying to help other people. We don't claim to be medical professionals, you know, trained professionals, doctors, anything like that. It's just structured peer support with a program underpinning it.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't minimise the value of structured peer support. And I mean, I've had a look at the website today, GamFam. It's .co.uk, isn't it?
.org.
Apologies. GamFam.org for anybody who wants to check it out. Brilliant.
.org.uk.
Apologies. Okay, GamFam.org.uk.
That's it.
And I'll put that in the description of this episode as well. That, you know, a lot of work has been put into developing this, and program development is not easy. Myself and Tony have done bits and pieces of it. It requires a lot of time and energy and thought and research. And, you know, certainly myself and Tony don't refer to ourselves as experts in anything. And every day is a school day for myself, for Tony, for yourself. Obviously, you have a mind that is open to the reality that every day is a school day and every day is an opportunity for learning, and we're all just works in progress, right? And I think that's a good place to be coming from. And for any of us, you know, it doesn't matter what the situation is, if we can buy ourselves a little bit of time by, you know, counting to 10 or taking a time out when we're in a heated discussion with our nearest and dearest, and being able to buy ourselves a little bit of time and say, okay, how do I respond in this situation rather than a emotional knee-jerk reaction that's probably in some sort of loop that, you know, learned behavior that's been going on for a long time. How can I respond, you know, switch on the human part of the brain, say, and just take a couple of seconds. Sometimes a couple of seconds can make all the difference. And we'd say this to people in recovery from gambling disorder, gambling addictions as well. That a lot of the time you just want to buy yourself a couple of seconds. Same with anger management, stress management, you name it. And buy yourself the time to respond with thought rather than react the kind of a knee-jerk reaction. Tony, you wanted to say something there?
Yeah, just going back to the quote, I would have said a couple of weeks ago on the podcast, you know, Viktor Frankl, it's attributed to like the space between the stimulus and the response is where we can find our freedom and our strength. And that's the case with recovery, and also with, as you said, any other life situations, is that we get the stimulus, and that could be any life situation. It can be triggered to gamble, or it could be an argument, whatever it is, or as you mentioned, road rage. But there is a space between that and the response, and it's learning how to widen that space. And that's why, you know, when we're doing work with clients, it's kind of to widen that space, we might use products like Gamban, we might use, look at time, access, money control, and how to fill in that time, because it can just widen that space a little bit. That gives you that opportunity to press that emotional pause button that you mentioned. And again, it was interesting you said about, like, you know, trying to be a better version of yourself. Like, for me, recovery is about learning how to live again, learn how to enjoy life, learn how to be the best version of ourselves. And sometimes it's seen as this kind of horrible thing. I have to get into recovery. Like, it's seen as this nearly negative thing, but it's, you know, having gone through Coon Vera, I haven't done a lot of work on myself over the years. Yeah, I don't always get it right. I react like everyone else, and Barry can be testament to that, because I usually ring him at odd times to have a bit of rant. I had a bit of a rant last night as well. But that kind of, that ability to recognize that and then make those subtle changes. As you said, you don't always get it right, but then you can say, well, you know, maybe the next time someone cuts across you, you might hold off and beep in the horn for a couple of seconds until you see who's in the car, and then you might let volley at them. But I think that the ability to do that is learning how to live our best lives going forward. And I think for me, that's recovery. It's not just about not gambling or not drinking or not using drugs. It's about how to learn how to live our best lives. And I think recovery and structured recovery, like what you mentioned, gives us that opportunity. And just to finally come back in on what you're saying about the group, I remember coming on to that group tonight. It was a good few months ago now, and I have to do another one in the next couple of weeks, which I'm really looking forward to. Coming on that group, then I was fierce nervous, because like, I've delivered a talk to schools, I've delivered it to organizations, but to come into family members who've been directly impacted, I was kind of going, oh no, this is going to be absolutely, you know, and we were doing it by Zoom, which is probably even more difficult, because it was one of the first ones I'd done via Zoom. I remember we started off about 7:30 or something. I was still chatting down there at nearly 10:15 that night. And the recovery and the support that you could feel coming through the computer screen from the family members was actually inspirational to me, having the opportunity to speak to them and to kind of feed off what they were saying back to me. It gave me a lot of insight into my own recovery and what I needed to do as well. So it worked both ways that night, that you know, the family members got some insight from me, but I also got insight from them of, you know, of parts of my story that maybe I don't recognize, or maybe I push back because it's too painful to kind of really connect with how it has impacted more people. Like, I know that, you know, you have the close family members who is after impacting, but they kind of maybe think that now this is after having even more of an impact on more people than I realized. And it was a really good insight. And again, as you said, it's about everyone learning off each other and being on the same page, and the ability to use that knowledge and that experience to help more people going along. I know that's what you do within the groups as well.
Yeah, I think we're fortunate. We still go to Gammon as a family. We are a really important part of what we do, because it was there for us, and we feel that, you know, a new person might come through the door and we want to support people there. So we go to Gammon. My son still goes to GA, and some of the open meetings that we go to are some of the most powerful meetings that we've seen. And as you said, the energy, the inspiration in those rooms is just incredible. And to hear you say that, you know, you felt that on one of our groups is, you know, is very, very rewarding. To someone like yourself that feels that. So thanks for that. Thanks for saying that. It's much appreciated. Can I just go back to you said about the, you know, sometimes when we do overreact, part of one of our tasks in our program is taken from the chimp paradox, is that development time. So it's, you know, it's taking that 10-15 minutes the next day just to sit and reflect on your day. And when you got it right, it was probably your human part of your brain reacting. And when you got it wrong, it was probably your chimp. And it's okay if the chimp represents, but it's learning from that. And it's taking that time to go back and reflect all the time. And the other thing is, we don't give absolute advice on the groups. It's not about that. But the one thing that we do tend to hear ourselves saying quite a bit is, you know, don't whatever you say you're going to do, you've got to stick to is where we are. But and the counter argument to that is, don't over promise and threaten things when you're in anger. And I think that's what we do. we say these things when we're angry, and then we find ourselves backing down because, you know, we didn't really mean that because we were angry. So that's where, you know, using the gym paradox helps as well, because you give yourself that bit of breathing space and that, you know, bit of time. And we'll take that, people, if they're backed into a decision, just give me 5 minutes to think about that. You can go away, you can talk to your partner or other family member to try and get to a decision. And another thing we always say as well, with picking your moments as well, you know, when you are talking and you are trying to move things forward, it's about picking the right moment as well. I think it's really important.
Yeah, and just to come in on that quickly, I went into full King Kong mode there a couple of weeks ago where I just cleared decks at one stage with it. Like, it was just one of those really bad moments and bad days. And we all have them in recovery. I think it's important, like, while we want to be thinking from the human side of it the whole time, it's okay to drift into the chimp side. And, you know, like, I remember sitting and as you were saying, I really reflected on it afterwards, the day after, and also I reflected on it with my partner as well. And the one thing I said, like, I wanted to feel that way in that moment. Now, it wasn't healthy for me in that moment, but I was okay. I felt I wasn't at risk of relapsing or a risk of being, harmed myself or others. But I definitely felt that I definitely went into chimp mode, full on. But I was able to navigate it, I suppose, through the experience of my own self-care, personal development. But it took me a while to come down off that heightened chimpanzeeisms and come back down into kind of normal thinking again. And when I reflect on it, I remember thinking, well, I need to change some of these coping skills around this. I need to kind of be able, in this real triggering situation, to take that step back and be able to press that pause button, as you were mentioned. But it was really difficult because that's one of my biggest triggering in my recovery, but the ability to kind of take a step back. Now, I have put things in place since, so it is a learning curve, but I think it's also important to say it is okay for us to get overwhelmed and go into chimp mode every so often. But it's about, as you said, it's about not staying there. It's about reflecting, coming back down into the human brain, and also reflecting, how can I not go to that place again? And then, you know, we're always going to, like, there is going to be days, even if it is an old woman pulls across you in the car, you are going to lay on the horn because you're just having a bad day. Mm-hmm. You know, like, it all comes back to self-care, having that meetings, having that support, having that place where you can have that rant and rave, so that you're slightly left off the pressure cooker every so often, whether that's every week on your meetings, or whether it's GA meetings or Gammon On, or whether it's counseling session. It's just ability to be able to let off the steam and have a space where you can reflect and you can talk with things without everything building up, because that's where the buildup leads to the overwhelmness, I think.
Yeah, and I think the groups as well, you know, often people come onto the group. I mean, the structure of our group is pretty simple, really. The people come in and we have a check-in, then we have a review of the week, and then we have a grasp focus. So it could be a topic or it could be a task that they've been working on. And then we have our checkout. And often people bring other issues and concerns to the group because they build up that trust within the group. And it's that opportunity that we don't want to be thinking and talking about gambling 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, because it can be really, really draining. But if you can come onto a group once a week, twice a week, whatever your routine is, and bring that there, you can talk to people that you can trust, you can air your concerns or worries, and then you can put it away again, and you can sort of live that normal life, that life without gambling, which is fine. We spend most of our time, you know, worrying about what's happened in the past, stressing about what's going to happen in the future. We forget to enjoy the moment, and that's what our stage two is all about, is trying to sort of appreciate living in that moment. And, you know, accepting that, you know, our loved ones have got a gambling disorder for the rest of their life, that's fine. But we can learn to live with that, and we can cope with that, and we can put the barriers in place, you know, like you talked about, the GAN ban, the GAN stop, banking blocks, financial controls, using credit monitor, all of those things that you put in place. That all supports them in the moment if they sort of feel vulnerable, but it also gives us as affected others that reassurance that they're protected as well, which allows us to live that normal day-to-day life, free of gambling, thinking and talking about it every single moment of every single day. So that's
important
for us.
Brilliant. And I'm sure Barry agrees, coming in there now, but I'm sure they agree that when we're working with clients, yeah, the first couple of sessions might be about the gambling, but normally it's about feelings and emotions and about situations and about managing situations and having the space to be able to process that and talk about that in a safe space where there is trust. And that's, trust is the big word you use there. Like, people have to trust that it's okay to have a bit of a rant about something on the group. And it's good that you have that little bit of flexibility in the structure as well that allows that growth within the group as well.
In some weeks, you know, we'll have a focus, a grass focus, and we might not get onto it because people have brought, you know, things to the group, and that, you know, that's the flexibility that we've got within the group, and which is fine. And we try to keep meetings to about an hour and a half maximum. Sometimes they overrun, sometimes they're slightly shorter, but we aim for about an hour and a half a week on those. So the other thing, can I just say one thing as well, Barry? Something that you said about learning. It's a learning every day, it's a learning opportunity. So where we've moved remotely and working online, our program is online as well. So, you know, we've got a pilot group that's been running for probably over a year now, and they've been really, really important. If you look at the very first model of the grass program, it's where it is today. It's changed because we've looked, oh, that didn't work so well. We need to change the order of this. We need to introduce this. That task wasn't so clever. So, you know, we changed that and adapted that. So our groups are always continually developing and improving, you know, way the program looks. A good example is stage one, task two is about going to do your own research about gambling disorder and what it is. And one of our group members said, well, where do I start? You know, Google's a big thing. So we then got together a set of resources that we trusted and respected, and we put that into the program. So when our new members go through on stage one, task two, they're actually signposted to some podcasts and videos, some books, etc., which helps that. So there's lots of little tweaks that we've made along the road, and that's down to our group members taking an active interest in our program.
Yeah, it's great that, I suppose that's the great thing about doing a pilot, is you can go, okay, what's working here, what's not working. You're getting feedback from the group in real time, and I suppose it's a sign that it's a good organization when you're taking the feedback on board and adapting it as you go along, because you, of course you're going to learn so much from the people who use the service, right? You know, they have a different perspective on it rather than, say, the person who developed it. And, you know, I suppose we have that fluidity and that flexibility as well, where we have a program that we work to, but then somebody comes in one day and there's some stuff going on in their lives, and okay, we park the program for today, and this person needs to talk about this thing, and it's important and it's relevant to their recovery. And so we can't just box ourselves in and say, no, we're gonna do whatever, a cost benefit analysis today because it's session three. You know, you can't, you know, I don't think it's healthy to work that way. So to have some degree of fluidity and flexibility within an established or well-developed program, I think it is really healthy and helpful as well. You mentioned something earlier on, a couple of things that were really important. I don't want to kind of leave them undiscussed or unpacked, if I go really, really American. So the one of the things you mentioned was, you know, don't overpromise or don't kind of make statements in the heat of the moment, like, you know, the nevers, you know, the always and the nevers, the kind of black and white stuff that we all have a tendency to do when there's a rush of blood to the head. I suppose we see this a lot in our work with people in early stage recovery, especially if they're coming in to starting counselling on the back of an ultimatum. You know, maybe the partner has told them 10, 20, 50 times that the next time I catch you gambling, I'm kicking you out. Of course, for the person who's gambling, they're like, after the first five or six times, like, this is just white noise now, right? This person is never, ever going to do this until, of course, you know, everybody has a breaking point, and then the partner, the affected other family member reaches that breaking point, and suddenly the person with the gambling disorder is sitting in a counseling room going, what just happened? Right? It's much, much healthier. And I would say the same thing to family members. And family members naturally, whether it's gambling or I've worked with family members around drugs and alcohol as well, family members naturally have a natural instinct to want to jump in and help their loved one, right? And I suppose, especially if it's parents in particular as well. And to fight that urge is not an easy thing, right? To not, let's say, financially bail out the person with the gambling disorder, which is probably one of the common things that a lot of affected others, family members, parents, do. And then they say, well, this is the last time. It's the last bailout. You're never getting another bailout again. And then cut to 6 months later to get another bailout. Like, is that the sort of thing that you're talking about?
And yeah, it's like you're reading my mind there. It's exactly what happened with us. And I think the important thing is, and I keep going back about buying yourself that bit of time. If ever, and this is everyday life, just any parenting issue or any sort of everyday life, you know, me and my wife now are on the same page, and we wasn't always. And we will talk about things now, and we'll come to a decision. And once we've got that joint decision, whether it's right or wrong, you know, we're working on it together. And we always think it's tougher for partners, you know, when they're on their own dealing with it, and they've got no one else to bounce ideas off, or because often people become isolated with this, you know, the shame of a gambling disorder. We want to break that stigma down that, you know, programs like the Paul Merton program that's going out next Monday on BBC One, I think will help bring gambling disorder to a wider audience. And I think our challenge is bringing it to people who haven't been personally affected or directly affected by it. And if we can get to that stage, I think we're on a better way forward. Yeah, I think in our situation, we did overpromise, and we did say things that we weren't prepared to follow through on. And the moment we stopped doing that, we found ourselves in a better position. And we did that by having a bit more of a measured approach and using things like the there as well.
Well, I mean, within that, because I mean, you mentioned the 12 things to do, would there be anything in that around recommendations, say on, let's say, financial bailouts, which is a common one that comes up?
Yeah, our number one for families is don't give any money away if you think you're going to use it to gamble. You know, that's the number one. But obviously, it's easy to be manipulated in those situations. And we're only trying to help our loved one, and we think we're doing the right thing. But we mustn't give money to gamble. But the other thing is putting those barriers in place, and it's very easy to say, oh, just put Gambling on, put Gamtop on. But if the person who's in recovery doesn't want to engage in that, then that's really, really challenging. And as I said, we were accessing support for 3 to 4 months before my son decided he was ready to start his recovery. And we often work with people at that stage. So it's about being patient. But those 12 things that we do, that we give out at the start of our program, isn't saying that these are the 12 things you have to do. These are just 12 practical suggestions that could work. And you haven't got to do them all today, but we give them out to give that bit of hope that when your loved one is ready to engage, then, and it's good. We talk about timing. It's when they're malleable, when they've, you know, might have had a large breakout and they're willing to attend some therapy or some counselling or go to a peer support group, or willing to have some blocking software on their devices, or willing to have someone do their finances. That's when these 12 things to do can kick in at different times. And you know, we learn from one another all the time. People on our groups come on and make suggestions about, oh, have you seen this? It works. And, you know, we've learned from about how the Revolut card works as well. That wasn't on our original thing to do, but we understand how the Revolut card works now. We're big fans of Monzo. Monzo's a really, really positive sort of tool to help people manage their finances. But there's also the banks are now sort of getting their acts together a little bit now, and some banks are putting blocking software on as well. So, you know, just changing banks isn't always an easy thing to do. So it's, first of all, we would suggest looking at what your bank offer, and if not, try and find a solution that fits your situation. The other thing we recognise is that everybody's recovery is unique. The reason people get into gambling is different reasons. You know, we talk about the products, we talk about the advertising as well, how highly addictive some of those products are. So we recognise that, you know, everybody's story is different, and we want to have a flexible approach. And with our program, it's really important that it was proofread by quite a few people from different backgrounds as well. So it just wasn't seen as the ramblings of a madman like myself, you know. So it's a variety of influence as well, from people in recovery, from family members, from people that I've also had people read it there, but no understanding of what a gambling disorder is, because often people who come into our program haven't got any understanding or any clue. So it's important that we've had a wide variety of people sort of review it as well, and give, you know, constructive feedback.
You mentioned self-care earlier on. I'm just conscious of the time, and I really want to try and hit off this one before we finish up today. And thanks again so much for your time today, Steve, because we're that we're getting across some really important stuff here. You mentioned the self-care, the oxygen mask, one analogy, which is, you know, that they say, if you have
it's not mine, someone...
Of course, it's an old chestnut, people may have heard it before, but it's that one of, if the oxygen mask come down on the plane and you've got a child beside you or kids beside you, you put on your own mask first. Your natural instinct as a parent in that situation to put the mask on the kid first, but of course you could pass out in the process of trying to do that, and then nobody gets a mask, right? And it could be, you know, give an example of drowning or whatever, that somebody is drowning and you jump in and now you've got two drowning people, right? Like, so sometimes, you know, we need to take a moment to go, okay, what's the, you know, is it better if I throw a life ring into the drowning person? We have to, whatever metaphor you want to take for it, the person, the affected person, quite often is parents, partners that would contact us, has to focus on their own self-care. If you're burnt out, run into the ground, getting no sleep, stressed out of your head, dwelling on the past, as you said, worrying about the future, you're no good to yourself, and you're certainly no good to your loved one who has the gambling disorder. And the natural instinct, especially with parents, is to run themselves into the ground, do everything they can, worry, 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 stress, stress, stress. And, you know, they're getting burnt out and they're probably not helping the person with the gambling disorder as effectively as they might want to, right? But trying to get, in my experience, trying to get parents in particular to pull back and say, look, you need to start taking care of yourself, and then you will be in a better position to help your loved one, right? Definitely. Do you find that that's a difficult one to get people to...
Yeah, people come onto our groups and they want absolute answers. They want a blueprint of how to sort of navigate through this. But there isn't any right or wrong answer. It's you've got to find your own route into this. And probably the first thing is understanding that you've got no control over someone else's gambling is probably really, really important. It's hard to say that you're powerless over somebody else's gambling. From a GA state, step one in GA says that. But we try to solve someone else's problem, and by doing that, we make it our own problem. So we have to step back from that, and we have to realise that our recovery is equally as important for the reasons, you know, you've just described there. It's so important that we spend time on ourselves, and part of the Suffolk Mind program and part of the Your Needs Met program is a big section on sleep there. And we're not saying getting a good night's sleep is going to solve all your problems, but by sort of doing some things, some positive things to help you sleep. Because when you're in the middle of the fog, it's the last thing you think of when you go to bed. You dream about it all night, and then you wake up and it's the first thing on your mind, and you end up not getting decent levels of sleep, and then you can't cope the next day. So a decent night's sleep, as you say, is really, really important, because it can help us cope with things on a daily basis.
Yeah, it is. It's something that family members generally resist, and of course there are loads of stressors there that would interfere with come between you and your night's sleep as well. So I mean, it's not as easy as, well, just get a decent night's sleep and everything's going to be sorted. Of course good sleep helps with your mental health and reduces your stress levels, no doubt.
When people come onto the groups, what they're doing is they're getting that understanding that they're not the only person that's going through this. They can relate to people on tradition, and people learn from one another. People come up with suggestions and, you know, tips, hints, tricks that they could try and help in their own life. And, you know, the amount of people that are not aware of the practical barriers that you could put in place to protect yourself as well as your loved one, so they can learn from that. But then there are just different coping strategies as well. And often people come onto our groups where their loved one is still gambling. And we found that was a bit of a gap for us, where, you know, we didn't have anyone to sort of refer those people into. So as Tony alluded to previously, we've just started 6 months ago, we've just started a group for those directly in recovery, the gamblers. And we've got someone working with us now called Dean Frost, who's he now runs two groups, and we're looking to develop that. And we're in the process of writing our own GRASP program for the gambler. We've written our 10 things to do, you know, which is very similar to the 12 things to do. And interestingly, we use both of those lists on both groups. So I often use the 10 things to do for the gambler on our family groups. Dean and I are currently writing the new program. We're taking out the things that are transferable and we can work on both programs, but it needs a completely different approach as well. And obviously Dean's walked in that path, and he can help us get to a program that's relatable. But we'll follow the same model. We'll put that out to people that we trust to read it, to give us feedback. We'll then get a pilot group going with that to work through the program, see what works, see what doesn't work, and make sure we change it up. But yeah, we're quite excited to get that started, because we've got people coming onto our groups. Let's say their son or their partner's not engaging in any support. They come onto a group with Dean, and they also get some support. And it gets into the point where both parties are now working in the same direction. There's no magic formula. There's no silver bullet to this. It is that opportunity to talk to people who understand what you're going through, what it is. And hopefully through our programs, we start replacing that anger and resentment with a bit of gratitude, and hopefully a bit of people working towards recovery.
Brilliant. Well, listen, Steve, I know that we're kind of coming to the end of the time here, and I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today, and obviously for taking referrals from Ireland that Tony's been feeding into your service.
Can I just say, I always say to Tony, every person he sends over are just nice, decent people. Every single person. Is there no nasty, horrible people in Ireland?
None. Zero.
Except for the ones running
the country.
And they're just lovely, genuine people. And, you know, we're delighted to be able to work alongside Tony and support those people. And you know, it's great the feedback you get as well, Tony, from them. They're really, really positive. And, you know, we really, really enjoy working alongside you.
Brilliant. Steve, for anyone who wants to, because we'd have a mix, obviously most of our listeners are in Ireland, but we'd have a lot of people from the UK and from other countries as well. If people wanted to get in contact and find out more, how would they do that?
Yeah, so we've got our website. We've got www.gamfam.org.uk. They can email me directly, steve@gamfam.org.uk. There's the info@gamfam.org.uk. We're on social media. As GamFam Charity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, or just search GamFam, and hopefully they'll find their way to our website, or they could contact you guys, and you know, I'm happy for you to refer people in as well.
Brilliant. So listen, thanks so much for talking to us today, and thanks so much for all the work that you're doing and the support that you're providing to people in the UK and in Ireland, and like the resources that you have on the website for anybody who's in this kind of situation with a family member or some sort of a loved one with a gambling disorder, gambling problem, whatever name you want to put on it, check it out at gamfam.org.uk. Brilliant, brilliant stuff on there. Would you be okay if we link to the 12 things to do PDF as well in this episode?
Yeah, I'll send you a link, and I can also send you the 10 things to do for the gamblers as well. And just also as well, Dean's email is dean@gamfam.org.uk. So if there's anyone who's in direct recovery and they'd like to speak to someone, Dean will do a screening call to talk about what his program's about, and then obviously try to get them onto a group. And same if there's affected others, they can come and speak to me, and we can deal with that as well. But yeah, I'll make sure you've got copies of that, and by all means, please do reference. We just want to help people. We want to, hopefully people won't make the same mistakes we did, and they can join the dots up a bit quicker than we did. That's the whole purpose of what we're doing.
Brilliant. Listen, thanks a million, Steve Watts from GamFam. Keep up the great work, and thanks for talking to us today. Bye.